I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's been a frenzy of activity at the federal courthouse in Washington, D.C., in anticipation of a massive influx of highly sensitive cases after the Supreme Court today ruled that detainees at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba have the right, under the Constitution, to challenge their detention in U.S. civilian courts. This is the third time the High Court has ruled against Bush administration policy. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote for the majority, saying the laws and Constitution are designed to survive and remain in force in extraordinary times. Dissenting Justice Scalia wrote that the decision will almost certainly cause more Americans to be killed. We turn first to SCOTUSblog.com's Lyle Denniston, Here and Now Supreme Court reporter. He's at the court. Lyle, you call this a stunning blow to the Bush administration's war on terrorism policies. What struck you most about the 5-4 ruling as you read it?
The most important thing that jumped out at me immediately was that this was basically an effort by the court to maintain the independence of the judiciary from the executive during a time of hostilities or what the government considers war. The court's decision is based very heavily upon the notion that the Constitution requires the separation of important government powers between the executive branch, that is the presidency, and the federal courts, and particularly the Supreme Court. So this is really another reaffirmation by this court with its new justices in dissent of the theory that's prevailed for several years here that the Supreme Court is very jealous of its own prerogatives and will indeed go to considerable lengths, even in the time of war, to defend those choices and those powers that it has under the Constitution.
Yeah, the Bush administration made the case that extraordinary times called for extraordinary measures, including this detention in Guantanamo Bay. But Justice Kennedy, as we said, writing in the majority opinion, said no, extraordinary times call for the laws and Constitution as they stand. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Alito, Scalia, and Thomas dissented. Tell us more about what they said.
Well, both the Chief Justice in his dissenting opinion and Justice Scalia were arguing basically that what the court was engaging in is an act of judicial triumphalism, that is, asserting powers against the president in a time of war. Both of them accused the court of using flimsy historical and legal reasoning in order to get to their result. The Chief Justice's opinion is somewhat more modestly worded. Justice Scalia's opinion, as one would expect, is considerably more aggressive and suggests very strongly that this opinion is going to result in really major problems for the government in trying to manage people that are captured during the war on terror.
Well, then he out and out says it'll cause Americans to be killed. That's Lyle Denniston. He writes for SCOTUSblog.com and also reports for us here on Here and Now on Supreme Court decisions. Lyle, thanks so much.
I'm happy to do it, Robin.
Well, Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington University. And, Jonathan, we preface by saying you have an opinion on Guantanamo Bay. You've called it a gulag, as has Amnesty International. But we are looking for your legal expertise right now. And, Jonathan, already we're hearing from the military lawyer for Osama bin Laden's driver. He says, based on today's court findings, he's going to ask that he's going to file a motion to dismiss the charges against his client, saying that because he now has constitutional rights, his lawyer will say he did not have the constitutional right to a speedy trial. Are we going to start seeing more of these?
Well, we very likely will. I think it's a good thing. But I think that also we can step back and objectively judge this ruling for what it is. That is, there are relatively few times in our history where you have this type of nose-to-nose, toe-to-toe conflict between the branches. But this is one of them, and I expect it will go down as one of Kennedy's longest remembered and perhaps, and I think, justifiably most respected opinions. It was an amazing opinion. It was 70 pages, and he went into the great writ at great length and explained why there really was no alternative but this ruling in a nation committed to shared powers and the rule of law.
But we should say that it doesn't mean that it's over yet. There's roughly 270 detainees being held at Guantanamo. We hear most of them are expected to challenge their cases. If they go to the federal courts, and we hear the courts in Washington are bracing for this, and let's say a judge rules for or against their challenge, doesn't that go back to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court will then determine whether or not President Bush could hold detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
Yes, I think that this is likely to work its way back through the federal system. No one's going to jump out of Guantanamo Bay like they hit the lottery. This simply means that they will be able to go to a real court and be heard by real judges, and that their rights will be adjudicated by federal law, not the rules written by President Bush and his aides. And so there will be a very significant difference in terms of process. And for those of us who have been long critical, you know, I do national security cases, but like many of us in this area, I refuse to handle Guantanamo cases because I objected to the rules. But for many of us who have been critical of it, this is a great moment. You know, it really does show that we have a system that has just enough safety features that it can protect itself and even repair itself.
But, Jonathan, I want to ask you one last question. We're going to take this up again, obviously, as these cases start to come forward. Isn't it going to be virtually impossible to have these cases come to civilian courts? How is a lot of what, you know, whether you accept it or not, the administration says is highly sensitive material, how is that going to be put forth on a civilian court?
Well, that was always a red herring. You know, I do primarily classified work. I deal with classified documents all the time. I've got two terrorism cases that I have to do much of my work in a SCIF. So we deal with classified cases all the time. That's not a very good excuse. What the administration is worried about is that they can't prosecute these cases because they tortured some of these guys. And that is a real concern because it's going to be a hard thing for a court to allow evidence of coercion and torture to be used. And the great irony is that we have gotten nothing from these tribunals. We've spent millions of dollars, lost international credibility, and now the administration will have to fight hard to even convict these individuals when it could have convicted these people years ago by simply giving them due process.
Jonathan Turley, professor at George Washington University Law School, commenting on today's Supreme Court 5-4 decision that detainees at Guantanamo Bay have the right to challenge their cases in U.S. civilian courts, and most observers expect that to happen soon. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Computer World magazine recently did a fascinating examination of the number of workers in the high-tech world with Asperger's. Asperger's is a highly functioning form of autism, the syndrome that affects a person's ability to communicate or relate to others. And people with Asperger's, or Aspies as they call themselves, may have difficulty picking up nonverbal cues or functioning in social situations. But they're whizzes at figuring out complex computer problems. As one system administrator with Asperger's told his employer, "I can make your systems efficient, but I can't make your users happy." Well, Computer World contributing editor Tracy Mayer joins us with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, we're radio, we're not television, so there's not a crawl of words below me on your radio screen to say constantly over and over in this interview. You are not saying that all people with Asperger's work in high tech or all people in high tech have Asperger's.
No, not at all.
Just tell us, you know, what some of the people you interviewed, and you interviewed several, said to you about having Asperger's and finding a home in the tech world.
Asperger's people, by and large, not everyone, are very interested in the way things work and the way things are put together. So they're a natural for high tech, which is also concerned with the way things work. But some people can be really great at looking at the way the machine or software starts to interact with people. And they can almost do a better job than neurotypicals in looking at that interface.
Neurotypicals.
Well, that term was new to me. It basically means anybody who's not an Asperger's person or on the autism spectrum. It means everybody else.
But in your article, Tracy, you talk about meeting people with Asperger's who have found jobs in the computer world or the high-tech world who embrace it just because they don't have to directly interact with people. They can go through emails. There are systems set up where it does limit the amount of social interaction they have to have.
Right. It's not that they're not social. It's that random social interactions with people that you're not already close to, which is the definition of a lot of workplaces, are not useful and can really distract you. Some Asperger's people like to go really deep. They like to take a coding problem and work on it 12, 14 hours. If you're getting yanked into meetings, if people are dropping by for snacks or whatever, if it's a very social office, That's not going to work for you if you have those kinds of needs. So a lot of high-tech jobs up until very recently had a big component of go off and fix this problem for a day, a week, a month, and you could do a deep dive. You often became very close with two or three fellow programmers or whatever your specialty was, but you're not sitting in a room with 30 people
right.
having
and
lunch.
And if you do interact with them, it can be done through technology. But you found, Tracy, that there's still a stigma attached to saying that you have Asperger's, which is sort of further complicating the problem because, well, as one of the people you spoke to said, if only you know, people who had Asperger's turned green, then there'd be a way of letting people know this is an issue we have. How can we work with it?
A lot of people, and we found this with our article, don't know what Asperger's is, or they know it maybe through where it's starting to come up through the kids. It's starting to be diagnosed in children much more frequently as part of this much, much higher incidence of autism. It doesn't really occur to most people that there would be adults who are very high functioning, seem to be doing terrifically, who have Asperger's.
So it's a syndrome that employers can't immediately put their finger on, and that becomes a problem because they may be questioning, say, the isolating behavior or lack of eye contact with an IT employee without knowing that that employee has Asperger's. But as we said, it's hard for employees to tell employers because they feel there's a stigma attached. Now, when you contacted Microsoft, Google, and Yahoo, you got very few responses to your questions about Asperger's workers. In fact, one of the responses you kept getting was, we're not able to respond. But there is a rumor floating around that employees told you about that one company has set up a buddy system.
There is rumors. From several people we heard this, but again, they weren't confirmed, that Microsoft and perhaps some other companies have a system where somebody who has Asperger's is paired with a neurotypical employee, hopefully someone who's been there longer, who would say, this is the way the meetings work in our department. They kind of step you through, you know, we have family day and don't skip it because you actually don't have to participate, but it's nice to go and shake
just
the boss's
help them.
Hand.
Just kind of help
so they
them
just walk people through the things that might not be obvious to them.
Well, and you know, you cite another person that you spoke to whose boss also had Asperger's and so that they could together create an environment where they could limit, and these were their needs. They could limit the eye contact they had to make. They could limit the meetings they had to go to. They could set up systems so that employees contacted them through technology rather than face to face. But then when he left the company, you know, it eroded that. You know,
right.
They didn't have each other.
The more people you have with those kinds of behaviors and needs, the more the office is going to organize itself in a way that most people like.
Yeah.
Let's skip that meeting. Let's do email.
That's Tracy Mayer. She recently wrote the article, Asperger's and IT, Dark Secret or Open Secret, for Computer World magazine. When we come back, we'll hear from an advocate who says employers can and should make life on the job easier for Asperger workers. For instance, if they can't tolerate the radio of a coworker, can you move them? That's still ahead. Also later today, the MIT scientist who says, let the world build and run Iran's nuclear program. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Tracy Mayer, contributing editor at Computer World magazine. She recently wrote about how the high-tech industry is attracting people with Asperger's. That's a syndrome that's on the high-functioning end of the autism spectrum. Let's bring in Phil Schwartz. He's vice president of the Asperger's Association of New England. He says companies should and can accommodate workers with Asperger's who, as we've been saying, can have problems in the workplace because of the required social interaction, that sort of backslapping culture. Phil, tell us more about the problem.
I think there's a sensory component. Asperger's is not just, autism in general, is not just about social differences. It's also about sensory differences.
Do you mean someone with Asperger's wouldn't want to work in a very loud workplace with? Is that what you mean, sensory?
If someone were on the spectrum, any number of things might be sensory issues. Fluorescent lighting. A lot of people can see the strobing of a fluorescent light that can induce really disabling headaches and inability to function. Tactile stimulation. So you mentioned the backslapping sort of, you know, that can be an issue. I think unexpected sensory input, sudden sensory input, is just one part of it. And I think that interacts with the social part, because if you have sensory sensitivities, they may make you more reticent to get out there into social milieus where your senses are going to be challenged.
But you also met someone, Tracy, who said that this person wanted to know how to better interact, but you know, people weren't giving him the feedback he needed. And so he said when he missed certain social cues because of his Asperger's, he didn't know how to change his behavior. There were these little black holes, a lack of understanding.
Right. In the way a lot of organizations are set up through no fault of their own, there's many, many unspoken or sort of below the radar things. I could give you a look in a meeting that says, that's not good, don't say that in front of the boss. That could be missed.
Phil, you're nodding yes, we should say.
Well, yeah, I think one spends a lifetime figuring out what the expected responses are going to be, because there's one's own natural intuition about how to respond may not agree with the majority.
Well, Phil, we're hearing another issue is that an employer doesn't necessarily know that an employee has Asperger's because employees are afraid to say they have it. Why is that?
Part of the problem is the way that disability is perceived still in the workplace, even with the ADA.
And I just want to interject the Americans with Disabilities Act,
ADA,
the ADA
is American,
which has led to, you know, a lot of these advances.
The deaf community is a great example. Everybody's TV now has closed captioning, just as a matter of course. It's part of the universal design of TVs. But that's an accommodation for people with hearing impairments.
But
right.
Not for...
On the other hand, disability is seen as a negative thing, as something fraught with legal gotchas and so on for employers, so that if you present Asperger syndrome as a disability or only as a disability, you're going to bring all of that baggage.
Phil, I have to ask you, though, why should companies do this? I mean, you know, it costs money to have special programs for employees.
Because a lot of this can be approached not from the disability angle, but from the difference angle. And it's a matter really of just broadening sensitivities and opening the places in the corporate culture that serve as barriers, where they might be currently. And there's a lot of talent out there is not going to get leveraged because there are barriers to these people functioning well in the workplace.
We would argue that any kind of awareness or accommodation that you can make for Asperger's people is going to instantly save you money. You will have very bright, dedicated employees who will stay where they are and not be jumping ship. With a very few accommodations and maybe just an awareness adjustment, which does not require a special program, you can get an office full of really terrific, bright employees at a time when a lot of high-tech companies are having difficulty attracting the kind of talent that they're looking for.
And I want to say that the introspection about the corporate culture, the broadening of the corporate culture, I think benefits everybody because of the sort of baggage with which the label Asperger syndrome or autism is sometimes fraught. We tell people to focus on specific accommodations that they want to have made for them in the office and say, for example, I need those fluorescent lights disabled and can we bring in some halogens or incandescents? Or I communicate much better. Can we do this via email? If there are flex time hours available, if that's part of the corporate culture, making effective use of them to have time where one is undisturbed and has all the resources one needs to do one's work. That said, we're really in a sort of a chicken and egg conundrum, I think, around the whole issue of disclosure, and around it's very much very very close parallel, I think, to what the gay community has gone through in its history. We need to work not on an individual one-on-one level, but on a corporate culture by corporate culture level, to reach a tipping point where the A word is defanged, and where it's not such a daunting thing to do the little things that will make the corporate environment friendlier for those folks who are wired that way.
Well, and I'm thinking that cutting down on fluorescent lightings and meetings will be appreciated by the neurotypical as well.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
That's Phil Schwartz. He's vice president of the Asperger's Association of New England. Tracy Mayer is contributing editor for Computer World magazine. She recently wrote about Asperger's syndrome and its connection with the IT industry. Thank you both for coming in. Fascinating.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, speaking of corporate culture, tomorrow on Here and Now, if you're lucky enough to have paternity and maternity benefits and leave, have you noticed that that time you get off is getting shorter? We'll find out why and what expecting parents should do to plan in advance for time off when the time comes. Also, writer and illustrator Maurice Sendak, he's turning 80. We'll learn the dark inspiration for his children's classics, Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the brightest sounds of summer, from Usher to Coldplay. That's after the news, Here and Now. President Bush is in Rome today, continuing his campaign urging Europeans to join the U.S. in addressing issues like Iran's nuclear enrichment program. The U.S. and its allies have accused Iran of trying to develop nuclear weapons, and the U.N. Security Council has imposed three sets of sanctions against Iran for refusing to halt uranium enrichment. Well, earlier this week, President Bush said that diplomacy with Iran was his preferred option, but he went out of his way to emphasize that all options are on the table. In response, Iranian President Ahmadinejad called President Bush a wicked man and said that coercion wouldn't work. Well, the standoff has given new life to a compromise plan put forth by scholars at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They ask, why not help the Iranians build an internationally run enrichment plant to replace the country's current facilities? Jim Walsh is an expert in international security at MIT. He's at the heart of this proposal. So, Jim, what exactly is this? Outline it for us.
Sure. Robin, we face a real dilemma here. On the one hand, the Iranians say, we want to have enrichment on Iranian soil. And the U.S. position is zero tolerance. You cannot have a single centrifuge on Iranian soil. That's a pretty big gap between those positions. And right now, the centrifuges are winning the race against the sanctions.
How many do the Iranians have?
The Iranians have built a little over 3,000 centrifuges. They promised, after the last sanctions resolution passed the United Nations, to build another 6,000 centrifuges, and they're also working on new kinds of centrifuges, trying to develop new models and prototypes that are better than the existing ones they have. So we keep passing resolutions, but they keep building centrifuges, and they're doing it faster than we're doing it. So we're saying the current U.S. policy of sanctions simply isn't working, and we've got to do something else. And most of the other things we could do are equally or even more unpalatable, like military attack on their nuclear facilities or trying to push regime change. We say the way to get through this dilemma is to have enrichment on Iranian soil, which is what the Iranians want, but for it to be internationally owned and managed so that there are people on the ground 24/7, eyes and ears, who are watching that facility, watching the production of uranium, and therefore increasing our confidence that it's not being misused, that it's not being diverted to a nuclear weapons program.
There are other international consortiums, countries that get together and run nuclear plants. But how would you, in your proposal, safeguard against Iran, number one, figuring out how to take over the plant, or at least secretly maybe take it over and use the uranium for weapons, the uranium that's produced by the centrifuges? Or two, how do you prevent Iran from allowing you and the international community to install and run a plant while still running their own secret plants?
Well, these are all good questions. And the first one on diversion, is there any way they might be able to take material or technology from the legitimate plant and steal it away to a hidden plant? Well, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, they're good at some things and they're not so good at others. But the thing that they're really, really good at is detecting diversion. And so we're pretty confident that upgraded safeguards beyond what we have right now would assure that they weren't able to take anything from the good plant and move it over to a secret plant. Mm-hmm. Could they sort of renationalize it and take it over on their own? I think the answer to that is yes. In theory, they could do it, but that would come at a high political cost. We assume that the UN would pass a resolution consistent with this proposal that if that were to happen, that they would be subject to military attack. And it's also important to keep in mind, Robin, let's say that they renationalize the plant. Well, then they're at no different point than where they are right now.
Well, and we also read in the Boston Globe, Farrah Stockman's been reporting on this, that you have colleagues there at MIT who have been working feverishly on coming up with technology that would prevent them from stealing some of the enriched uranium or getting into the process of the plant.
Yeah, I have two colleagues, Jeff Forden and John Thompson, and they have a slightly different proposal. They would try two different things. One is a self-destruct mechanism, that if the Iranians took over the plant for some reason, that this would immediately disable the centrifuges or otherwise destroy them. And they're also working on what's called black box technology. And what that means is that there's a centrifuge and it runs inside this international plant, but it is essentially black boxed so that the Iranians don't have access to it and can't see how it works. So they are working on those things. I think in the near term, the Iranians are more open to the idea of simply multilateralizing or having an international consortium take over their existing centrifuges. But the thing to keep in mind is, you know, there's no good solution here. I would prefer that Iran have zero centrifuges if it was my first choice, but that's not where we're at. We have to be realistic here. The question is, at the end of the day, which policy gives us more assurance, more security that they're not going to have a bomb? It's a matter of comparing the status quo against the alternatives. Under the status quo, they're building centrifuges like nobody's business. There's no very little transparency, no knowledge about what they're going to do, and they have total control over that program, whether they accept UN demands or not. Under this international proposal, people are on the ground watching what's happened. I think it actually reduces the chances of a bomb compared with even the status quo.
Well, when you first proposed this to the Bush administration a few years ago, there was a completely cold response to it. Now people are warming to your thinking. Largely Democrats. Congressman Ed Markey from here in Massachusetts has endorsed your idea. Senators Feinstein, Chuck Hagel, a Republican, have also said it's worth exploring. You still have your critics who say this is impossible. It rewards Iran for bad behavior. But we also want to get in here that you've been talking directly to the Iranians. You just came back from The Hague, where you were speaking with some representatives there, and you're on your way to Tehran tomorrow, if I'm correct, to continue talks. What are they saying?
Well, they are open to the proposal. They, in fact, raised the proposal some years ago themselves, but they're cautious. Now, you know, just like in the U.S., there are critics of the proposal who think it's a Trojan horse, a way for the U.S. or others to sort of take over their nuclear program in a way that they would not want. Others are open to it, the sort of pragmatic conservatives, the folks who won this last parliamentary election in Iran. They're much more open to it is because they see it as a way to sort of resolve the nuclear issue and therefore lay the groundwork for better U.S.-Iranian relations. So there are different opinions, but when I talk to different facets of the government, whether it's in the president's office or their atomic energy program or in the foreign ministry, I get a much more positive reaction than a negative reaction. On the whole, they're open to the idea. Their last proposal endorses the concept of an international consortium, but of course the devil's in the details. But we can only find out what those details are if we sit down and negotiate.
Well, it would seem impossible that the current administration would want to go forward with your plan, but both Barack Obama and John McCain have in the past endorsed the general idea of using international organizations to run plants in unstable countries. Have either of the candidates said anything to you about your current specific proposal for Iran?
Well, we have had discussions with advisors to both camps, and they've both responded with seriousness and with openness and interest. So we know people in both camps. I think there's a basic openness to it, but we're going to have to wait and see.
Jim Walsh, an expert in international security at MIT, who, along with others, is proposing that the world help the Iranians build a nuclear plant, but then the world run it. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
So what are your thoughts on this or anything on the program? You can send them to here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.org. Or you can also call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Well, tomorrow is the last day of school for many kids across the country. But for students in the fourth grade at the Atrium School in Watertown, Massachusetts, it's the end of a year of lobbying as part of a unit on climate change and inspired by a website that we'll tell you about later. The class decided to petition town and state officials to reduce their carbon footprint. Nora Dooley is the class co-teacher. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin.
We're also joined by students Eli Berlin. Eli, welcome.
Thank you.
And Alana Huggins. Alana, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Alana, let's start with you. Your proposal to these officials was what? What did you tell them to do?
We told them to change the margins to save paper and trees.
Change their margins. Literally the things that you set on a, well, it used to be on a typewriter, but the thing you set on your computer that shows how much space is on the right and left-hand side?
Yes.
And Eli, what would that do by changing the margins?
Well, it would save paper, it would save trees, and overall it would slow down global warming.
I know that you have your computer here. Can you tell us just how many trees it might save and how many margins would have to be changed to do that?
If everyone in the U.S. changed the margins, we would save 6,156,000 trees.
Nora, how did you calculate 6 million trees?
We actually did have the kids do as part of our study some math around this, and they did a lot of research. They did persuasive writing. But we were looking for a way to reduce something that we used.
Well, okay, now comes the part where you learn about persuasive writing and appealing to your officials. Alana, did you write any of the letters? Were you part of that?
Yes. I wrote a letter to the Watertown Town Council along with someone who lives nearby me.
And this is a town right nearby us in here in Boston. And what did the Watertown Town Council do?
They're going to change all their margins.
How'd you feel when you heard that, that the officials in that town are going to change their margins because of you?
It was pretty exciting that I could do that much by just doing stuff that I already knew how to do. Writing letters and calling people.
Eli, I know you guys also went to the State House and you approached our governor here in Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, with the idea of the whole state perhaps changing their margins. What's been going on there?
We have gotten letters from representatives, and I think that we've been more successful with the towns than the State House, though getting letters is pretty important.
What would it mean if a whole state decided to tell all its town officials to change their margins?
Overall, our goal is for the whole world to change the margins. But what we thought was go from our school to the town of Watertown, which is where our school is, then go to the state, and then go to the country, then go to the world. Now, those country and world are two big things.
Yeah, they are.
They're our goal.
Well, it's a pretty big goal, Nora. What are some of the impediments you come across? I mean, I'm thinking, as a teacher, changing the margins, what would you write in when
exactly.
you grade things?
Well, you know, I'm a writer, too, and so we can't really submit manuscripts with margins that aren't large for people to write in. And people have said, you know, like certain lawyers or other people have said, we can't do this. So we had other suggestions, right, Alana, about other things you can do to save paper.
What are some of the other ways if someone just absolutely can't change a margin? What can they do, Alana?
They can make paper out of other things like bamboo, which will grow about 4 feet in 24 hours, and it doesn't kill trees.
Right. But the other thing, remember about double side, we have double side man and superheroes that would help us in this.
Yeah, so, Eli, tell us about those.
We did the names like Small Font Man.
Small Font Man?
Recycled Dude, Evil Skull Villain named D-Side.
Was it double side? Was it double side?
D-Side was supposed to stand for double side.
So in other words, use both sides of the paper.
Another thing you can do is use small font, which just works as well.
Getting more onto every piece of paper. Alana, I'm wondering, when you look at your books now or you go to a bookstore, do you find yourself like looking at margins everywhere?
It may be hard to believe, but sometimes I just can't tell the difference between changed margins and unchanged margins. I just hope people will change their margins, and if I can see it or not, if we slow down global warming, then it'll be pretty big for me.
Very cool. Well, I want to thank you all for coming to talk to us about
Thank you, Robin.
Boy, what a great class project. So that's Eli Berlin. Thank you, Eli.
Thank you.
Alana Huggins, thank you.
Thank you.
And their teacher, Nora Dooley, from the Atrium School in Watertown, Massachusetts. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Small font, man. I love it. And by the way, the website that inspired the students is changethemargins.org. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Just ahead, our pop music maven lets us listen in on her summer-ready iPod in 1 minute, here and now. Summer is here. With the heat comes hot music. So Here and Now pop culture maven Renee Grahan joins us in the studio to tell us about some of the hits that are already wafting out of car stereos and iPods. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
We call this summer preview. You call it?
Songs You'll Hate by Labor Day.
That's right. Well, let's start with the big ones. The artists that we're going to hear everywhere, Usher. His Love in This Club features Young Jeezy. Your thoughts?
It's a typical Usher song. It's really well produced. You know, it's not groundbreaking, but he's never been an edgy artist. He's a mainstream artist, and that's really served him well. It's a big deal somewhat because this is his first album since 2004's Confessions, which sold nearly 10 million copies. Not sure this album will be that big, but In This Club is a huge song.
To remind ourselves, a gospel-trained vocalist, natural talent, he was on Star Search, mentored by Sean Puffy Combs. You say mainstream. Does he have any edge or?
You know, he always works with the hot producers. He always has the best people as guest stars. I mean, one of his biggest hits was the song called Yeah 4 years ago, which was exactly inescapable.
Oh, but can we hear just a little of it again? I didn't get tired of this.
No, I mean, and Yeah is one of those songs, and 4 years later, I can actually listen to it again, as opposed to what was happening in 2004. I don't think Love in This Club is as interesting a song as Yeah, but it's fine. It's an Usher song. He's mainstream. He makes music for the masses. He's not trying to reinvent the wheel. He just does what he does, and he does it pretty well.
Let's move on to Lil Wayne's The Carter Three crossover.
It's hard to say. It is a crossover album for him, although Lil Wayne's been around for 10 years. He's out of New Orleans, came out of the Cash Money Millionaires rap group. And, you know, he's been calling himself the best rapper alive for the last few years. And, you know, I'm not ready to say that, but this album is absolutely going to break big. I mean, it really is. He's been this underground mixtape demon. He's always appearing on other people's records. It's about time that he really had that big, big radio hit. And he's got it now with Lollipop. This is how big this album is going to be. Lollipop has been number one, and he's already got two other songs from the album in the top 40.
The significance of this album's title, The Carter Three.
Well, yes, his actual name is Dwayne Carter. And what's interesting is on this album, he has a song called Mr. Carter with hip-hop's other great Mr. Carter, Sean Carter, who is, of course, Jay-Z. And in the song, Jay-Z kind of passes the torch of being the best rapper alive to Lil Wayne. Again, I'm not ready to say that. So long as Rakim is still alive, I'm not going to say Lil Wayne is the best rapper alive. But it's an interesting song. If you like that kind of really sort of southern, dipped, screwed up, slowed down kind of hip-hop sound, this is for you.
Lil Wayne and some of Lil Wayne's neighborhood there. Yes. in hip-hop. Let's move on to Coldplay. Okay, you know, everybody's saying they've just had it with Coldplay. Am I the only one still liking Coldplay?
I'm guessing you're not the only one, but I'm not with you.
Okay.
I will admit a grudging affection for Clocks, but this is a band that just bores me with a vengeance. You've got Chris Martin's needling little voice. You've got all these sweeping crescendos. I feel sleepy just thinking about them. But their new album's coming out, you know, Viva La Vida, Live the Life, kids. And, you know, it's the first single is already out. It's the title song. It seems to be doing really well. It's got that classic Coldplay sound, which is a sound they've made on every record they put out in the last 10 years.
It sort of is.
If you like that sound, you will obviously like this album.
But they're so sincere.
They're too sincere. You know, it just always sounds the same, and it always has this sort of mock importance because of all those crescendos. I do not understand that band's popularity. I just don't.
Okay, what will you be listening to?
What I'm listening to right now, two absolutely wonderful singers out of Britain. One is Estelle, who's has a single out called No Substitute Lover from her album Shine, and it's playful and also samples George Michael's Face.
I love that.
Executive produced by John Legend with an assist from Kanye West. She's just a wonderful singer. It's, you know, hip-hop, it's R&B. It sounds really fresh and nice.
Estelle. And by the way, we're going to have a list at our website, here-now.org, of all of Renee's picks. And who else are you listening to?
Another British singer. One has to wonder why all the best female soul singers are coming out of Britain these days, but also Duffy. She's been compared to Amy Winehouse, but without all the crack and smack issues that Amy Winehouse seems to have. But there are more differences. Duffy doesn't sound as world-weary as Winehouse does, probably because she isn't, but she can really sing soulful, girlish, and music just makes you feel good. And we're going to hear the single Mercy. I love you.
You sound, at least, you know, for some of us, Duffy out of England. All right, looking ahead this summer to Donna Summer's return. Amy Mann has a new CD coming out, My Morning Jacket. Give us something, you know, a taste of summer to go out on that you're looking forward to.
The great Al Green. He's got a wonderful album out called Lay It Down. He's been doing this for 40 years. Man, his first hit in 1971. He's got songs older than Lil Wayne and Usher. And he's still as great as he's ever been. And this is the title track, Lay It Down, with Anthony Hamilton.
Al Green just never fails us.
Never goes wrong.
Renee Graham never fails us either. Her list of summer picks is at our website, here-now.org. Renee, thanks as always.
Happy summer, Robin. I just love you. Really, I would really love you for free.